Oh, that was fun. Wonderful. Thank you, Ben. It ties in so well with what we're talking about this morning, waking up. Well, here we are in a new year, and back on the Jesus path we go. Our kids are coming over at the end of the service to do Eucharist with us, and I think that's going to be special. I'm looking forward to that. But throughout Advent, we talked about incarnation, how it calls us to a relationship with the land we live on, the people around us. And as we head back out onto the Jesus path, we come to Jesus' next big event in his life, baptism. But before we get to this event in Jesus' life, so much of the Jesus path is about remaining awake, waking up, as the song says, seeing God at work and around us, in the places we find ourselves in, with the people. And yet this is so incredibly hard to live and maintain. Falling asleep is so easy. You know, it's no accident that on the eve of Jesus' crucifixion, some of Jesus' final words to his followers were, "Stay awake." In the Garden of Gethsemane, Jesus, of course, is in this tortured moment, and he wants to pray. He brings his disciples with him, but you can almost hear the frustration in his voice when he has to three times wake his disciples up from sleeping. In Matthew 26, the story goes this way. Then Jesus went with them to a place called Gethsemane, and he said to his disciples, "Sit here while I go over there and pray." He took Peter and the two sons of Zebedee and began to be grieved and agitated. Then he said to him, "I'm deeply grieved, even to death. Remain here and stay awake with me." Then he came to the disciples and found them sleeping, and he said to Peter, "Oh, so you could not stay awake with me for 1 hour? Stay awake and pray that you may not come into the time of trial. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak." Again, he came and found them sleeping, for their eyes were heavy. Then he came to the disciples and said to them, "Are you still sleeping and taking your rest?" Jesus implores them, "Come on, stay awake." They couldn't do it, and it's hard for us as well. The metaphor here to me is incredibly rich, and it speaks to the difficulty, some of the challenges of traveling the Jesus path. We're constantly lulled to sleep, forgetting, unaware that God is at work among our land and our people. God is at work within ourselves. And despite Jesus pleading with them, they keep nodding off. They keep falling asleep. And I think the same voice of Jesus echoes to us throughout the ages. Stay awake. It's a good message for us heading into a new year. Stay awake. But it's hard. Such is the human condition. You know, despite our best efforts, we fall back asleep. We drift away from the moments in front of us. We fail to be present to the people and places directly in front of us. And so we have this call to stay awake, but it's hard. Why? Why is it so hard? Well, to unpack that, I want to start with a piece of art and its history. I love my art, of course. This is The Fortune Teller by Georges de La Tour. It's assumed that this was created sometime in the 1600s, because that's when Georges de La Tour was doing his work. But the interesting thing is this painting was only discovered after the Second World War. Somehow, this piece of his had gone missing for over 300 years. And as the story goes, there was a French prisoner of war, and he noticed in this house a piece that he thought looked very similar to Georges de La Tour's works. And so a knowledgeable priest was called in to take a look at it. Sure enough, the priest thought, "My goodness, I think this is a original Georges de La Tour." And so once the word got out to the art world, everybody wanted to see it. The Louvre in Paris desperately wanted to own it. And the thing is this, with museums, they know that exhibiting a work by someone like Georges de La Tour would pay them great dividends in the future. But an art dealer named George Wildenstein, he snuck into the midst and apparently outbid the Louvre. And he purchased the painting in 1949 for 7.5 million francs. Apparently that would be worth around $100 million today. And so for another 10 years, this work was left out of the public eye. But behind the scenes, many different museums were trying to convince Wildenstein to let them purchase this piece of art from him.
Of course museums wanted it. For a museum to own a Georges de Latour would guarantee them millions in future profits from grants, sponsors, tourism, visits. And eventually the Met, the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City, convinced Wildenstein to part with his beloved painting. And we don't know how much they paid for it. All we know is that it was an undisclosed but very high sum of money. And so the Met has this painting. But to me, it's a bit comical that they own it and paid a high price for it, given the message of the art piece itself. We know Georges de Latour was greatly influenced by Caravaggio. Caravaggio's works were often cautionary tales. And so Georges de Latour seems to be telling a moral story here with this piece. The work captures a moment when a young man, paying to have his fortune told, his future told to him, is being robbed. And the caution of the scene seems to be this: this young man is so preoccupied with the future and looking into the future that he doesn't realize he's being robbed of what he has right now. He's being robbed of the present. And so you can see the robbery comically at work. The woman on the far left is taking a little something out of his pocket, while the woman next to her has got her hand ready to receive the loot. Then, of course, the second from the right woman is chopping off some of his ornamental jewelry, while the seasoned veteran woman on the far right is convincing him, "I'll tell you your future for a small sum of money." And so this young man desperately, "Tell me about the future," doesn't realize he's being robbed of the present. That seems to be the message. Preoccupy yourself too much with the future, you'll be robbed of what you currently have. And what makes this art piece even more poignant to me is how the rest of the story goes. You see, the Met acquired this piece of work as an investment in their future. But perhaps they should have paid more careful attention to the message rather than the future profits they thought it would bring. See, in 1984, the piece's authenticity was seriously questioned by a world-renowned art historian. What's his name? Christopher Wright. Now, he has many technical suspicions about the work. I won't bore you with those details. But his suspicion starts with, well, isn't it convenient that nobody saw this for 300 years, and now it shows up as a genuine Georges de Latour? Suspicion seems logical, and he's convinced many that what the Met bought for an undisclosed but very high sum of money is nothing but a forgery. Art historians Rose Marie and Rainer Hagen, they smirk as they say this: there's a certain piquancy in the proximity of Wright's hypothesis of the painting as a forgery to the shady double-dealing shown in the fortune teller itself. We evidently live in a world of lies and deceptions in which not only immature youth, but also museum directors can be fleeced by cunning rascals. Oh, I like that. The Met maintains its authenticity, of course. But I love the message and how the story unfolds. When we become preoccupied too much with the future, we're often robbed of the present. And what lulls us to sleep is the challenge of being awake and present to the moment, is that our minds so often live in the past or future. It's August of 2019. I got to pick up my kids from my parents' house. They're an hour away. And as I take off on the journey, something ain't sitting well here. Got some stomach issues going on. And as I make the drive, things only seem to get progressively worse. I'm sweating. I can hardly concentrate on the road. I am in bad shape. By the time I get to my parents' place, I have to lie down. Something is seriously, seriously wrong. I grapple what to do for a moment, and then I realize, my body's telling me I need to go to the hospital. And so I call my wife. She picks up the phone. I say, "Listen, I'm not feeling well. I think I have to go to the hospital." And she says, "Well, I'm out on a bike ride. What do you want me to do about it?" Now, she's pragmatic that way. I suppose there's nothing she could do. A little sympathy might have been helpful, but said, "All right, well, listen, I'll call you when I figure out at the hospital what's going on." And so my mother drives me to St. Mary's in Stratford. I get there, and I get in really quickly, and the tests come back. The verdict is not good. My appendix is about to, I don't know, explode or something. They're like, this needs to come out immediately. And so I call Kristen again. Hey, you know how you didn't take me seriously? Well, yeah, my appendix has to come out. So she's like, she's a little bit more sheepish, has to get a ride from my brother down to see me, but she arrives, and the nurses are like, it's time. You gotta get going. And so I'm pumped full of morphine, by the way, at this time. The pain, I'm just riding high. And within a few hours, it's time for surgery. And so I'm tucked into a hospital bed, and a nurse pushes me down this hall towards the surgery room. Kristen is beside me, walking with me. We're going down the hall. And all of a sudden, the nurse says, okay, you need to wait here. And she just continues to push me down the hall. And then she leaves me alone in a hall, just waiting. And I felt like I was waiting there for an eternity, and as I'm waiting there, it suddenly dawned on me that I didn't even get to say goodbye to Kristen. I wasn't even able to give her a kiss goodbye. I wasn't able to pass on any messages that the kids might want to hear should things not go well. And listen, sure, I get having an appendix out is a relatively routine surgery. Even still, was very unsettled by not being able to say goodbye. I love you, in case something goes wrong. And I'm laying there, I'm bothered by that, and suddenly my mind starts to wonder, what if this is it? Recount, what was the last thing I said to Kristen? I think I mentioned my feet being cold. And then what was the last thing I said to the kids? I think it was something about a water gun. And I'm bothered by this. What if this is it? And suddenly it feels like my morphine rush has passed, and in its place, anxiety is filling every part of me. It's filling every part of me as I just lay there waiting to get cut open, and questions start racing through my mind. My brain starts playing out storylines about the future. What if my lifestyle has to change? What if I end up living in chronic pain? What if I can't eat again? What if I can't write? What if I can't speak? My mind is racing before me and playing out storylines of a future life marked by limitations. And then my mind takes me to my family. What if I can't wrestle with the kids anymore? What if I die? Will they be all right? How will it play out if I pass? I mean, my kids are young. Will they even remember me down the road? Will Kristen remarry? And I'm like, oh no. What if she ends up marrying some loser who treats her Bronson, my. That was good. A little loud, Bronson, but that was good. And so I'm struggling there, Bronson, because I'm wondering, what if she marries a loser again? And what if she has to eke out her days living with some jerk, and I'm bothered by it? But then something even more disturbing enters my mind. Wait, what if she marries someone great? This is very disturbing. What if she marries someone way better than me? What if she marries someone the kids love? Well, she ends up meeting someone who's never tired or cranky, someone who never inconveniences her while she's on a bike ride with their appendix. Well, she's marries someone a way better father than me, and then suddenly I have this vision in the future. I'm at one of my kids' wedding, and they're giving a speech at the end. And they're just like, oh my goodness, our new dad was the greatest. Put us through school, funded us, traveling across the world, always wise, never tired, just such a great man. And it's clear to everyone in the wedding crowd there that I was like the first iPhone. But the family had upgraded to like iPhone 14 once I passed. Back in the more immediate future, I'm troubled. I can see my kids laughing and hugging and playing with this imaginary man. I'm picturing Kristen in lingerie because he's so sexy. She can't keep her hands off of him. And I'm just like, oh my goodness. I'm losing my mind on this morphine high, thinking about the future. I'm livid at some imaginary future guy for stealing my wife and family. Deep in the turmoil of some imaginary future, I'm interrupted by a nurse. She says, all right, it's time. And she wheels me into the surgery room, and my nightmares go from bad to worse because I realize the operating table is shaped like a cross. And so they put me on the table, and they literally strap my arms and my feet in, and I remember talking to God. I said, listen, I know you said to take up your cross and follow you, but this seems a bit on the nose, don't you think there, God? I'm about to die, crucified in my own anxiety, convinced Kristen's already making a Tinder profile for herself. And then they put the mask on, a few heavy breaths, and then the lights fade. I'm gone. I suppose the moral of the story is that one should exercise caution before taking morphine recreationally, I think. No, I digress. 3 days later, I see a light, and 3 hours later, I wake up to bright lights and an alarm going off. And all I can hear in my left ear is this grumpy voice saying, stay awake. And I'm looking the direction of the light and the voice, and there is Kristen. And it's clear she hasn't remarried, but it's also clear she isn't happy. Stay awake. She said, what? She said, it's 3:30 in the morning. If you can't stay awake, they're going to have to check in for the night, which means I have to drive home and drive back tomorrow morning, and that ain't happening, so stay awake. I had survived. My family hadn't made an upgrade, and I was waking up to the sweet and affectionate voice of my wife, and for her, I would do anything, including staying awake. Well, the whole experience was disturbing to me, and in hindsight, it was rather curious. I mean, sure, the general lack of sympathy from my family and basically everyone was a little disconcerting, but what stuck out to me most were those moments in waiting. It felt like it was there for a half an hour, but during that half an hour, my mind had gone to so many weird places in the future, conjuring up these storylines about what a world without me might look like. And what I was doing is what Paul Young refers to as future tripping. I like that line, future tripping. My guess is you can relate to this term. According to Young, future tripping is creating imaginations of what is going to happen and then actually taking a mental and emotional trip to live there for a while. I've already done this in 2023. I don't know about you. Everybody's like, oh, recession's coming. So you start, I better think about what that will look like. So those mental trips we take into the future, we imaginatively explore questions like, oh my goodness, what will I do if this awful thing happens to me? What will I do if I make a terrible mistake and mess everything up in life? What am I going to do if I get that disease? I think my friend's mad at me. How is our next conversation going to play out? What happens if my kids are hurt or abused or something worse? And we think about these questions, and then we start in our mind playing into them in the future, thinking about them, playing out how we would respond. And questions like these start to wreak havoc in our lives, because it's the act of taking a trip into the future, pretending as if that were real. You get the idea. But here's the thing that the painting reminds me of. Future trip often enough, and what will happen is you'll end up getting fleeced out of what you already have. Because those imaginary mind trips that we take, they're imaginary. They're not reality, and yet they produce in us anxiety. In our heads, we treat these little trips into the future as if they were real, and we start living there with the anxiety they produce, but these imaginations aren't real. The projections into the future. It's like the wealthy young man trying to learn his future while being robbed of what he has. It's like the museum trying to ensure future profits and possibly ending up with a forgery. It's like me imagining into the future what my family would do without me. Flirt too much with the future and you end up being fleeced out of what is already yours. And why? Well, one of the things I'm trying to learn these days is what Paul Young says, God does not dwell in anything that is not real. And we know, we talked about this through the incarnation part of this series, we know that God is active and at work all around us, on our land, with the people closest to us, in our own lives. But when we move into speculations about the future, we've moved into a place where God does not exist. God does not dwell in anything that's not real. And in that space, we end up missing what we do have. End up missing what God is doing right here, right now. I think this is what Jesus was getting at on the Sermon on the Mount when he said, "Therefore I tell you, do not worry about your life, what you will eat or drink, or about your body, what you will wear. Can any one of you, by worrying, add a single hour to your life? Seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be given to you as well. Therefore, do not worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will worry about itself. Each day has enough trouble of its own." There's an obvious wisdom to what Jesus is saying here. Don't worry about tomorrow or stress about tomorrow. I think we get that, right? It's not like any of us say to our partners, "Hey, what are you doing Friday night?" "Nothing? Cool. How about we get a bottle of wine and sit and worry about the future?" Nobody does that. Nobody wants to do that. No one likes worrying. And yet, it's something most of us do on autopilot. And so there's some obvious wisdom from Jesus here, but there's something less obvious going on here. I think it's worth mentioning, because while this is sound wisdom, I'm inclined to think that few people stop worrying when they're told to stop worrying, right? In fact, I think being told to stop worrying can become a bit toxic if not done well. For instance, if you lose your job, it might make sense to actually worry a little bit about where, you know, money's going to come to pay for the mortgage, put food on the table. So worry sometimes is actually reasonable. There's wisdom to what Jesus is saying here, yet ridding ourselves of worry and anxiety, it's not only impossible, at times it would be, well, unwise to even try. This is why there's more to this passage. And it's this: when Jesus says, "Therefore I tell you," he's not talking to you. He's not talking to me, he's speaking to us. The "you" is plural. And you know, we Western folk, we love to individualize everything as if every Bible verse was directed specifically to me. But this is true not only of Matthew, but of every book in Scripture. They were written to communities. And so the message is, nexus, do not worry. The community of people, do not worry. It's about we, not me. And when we read these as communal words, there's a whole other level of wisdom here, because Jesus goes on to say, listen, instead of worry, try pursuing God's kingdom and path above all else. Then all the things you worry or stress over, they will be taken care of. They will be lessened. And I think what Matthew is doing here is encouraging us to travel the Jesus path in the context of community. Because I think what the subtext of what Jesus is saying is this: look, if you as a community, if you collectively pursue my path and kingdom, then your attention will be on things like these: kindness, hospitality, generosity, love, forgiveness, sharing burdens, sharing resources, pursuing reconciliation, being patient and gentle and kind. And let me tell you, if you focus on that as a community, there's a whole lot less to worry about. The message seems to be, walk the Jesus path in the context of community. And why? Because we would know we would be taken care of. You travel in the path of community, it lessens the worry that if I do something shameful or something really wrong, well, we would know that in those times, if we're traveling the community, we would be offered grace and kindness in times of personal shame or failure. We will know that we will find ourselves cared for when we can't carry ourselves. And I think that's what Jesus is getting at. Become the type of community that puts Jesus' kingdom and path first, and you'll find worry doesn't visit you as often. And so the path, as we travel it, it continues to reveal itself. The contours of it begin to take shape as we wake up and realize that God is in this place and we weren't aware of it. I think it means, again, continuing to learn the lessons of the incarnation. Find our people, find our place, and know that God is at work there. But sometimes we need practices, rituals to help us remember. I want to highlight Carla's spiritual direction groups. It's a new year. She's opening up to new groups that would do that. And as Carla and I have talked about spiritual direction groups, in essence, what they are is exactly about this: being awake and aware of where God might be working in your life. That's the purpose of them. And so perhaps find yourself, sign up for a spiritual direction group with Carla. I have a few little things that I do that help me remember to wake up, to be present, to be aware. First, this has carried over since COVID. Remember, you know, March, April 2020? I washed my hands so much they bled. Like, I was just like, every 5 minutes, I'm like, this thing, wash my hands. I washed them raw. And the wisdom at the time was, you should wash your hands as long as it takes to sing happy birthday twice. Remember that? In like 50 times a day, happy birthday. I'm like, I'm losing my mind. And so I simply replaced that with the Lord's Prayer. I'll wash my hands and I'll do that. And sometimes it's just going through the motions, but a simple ritual like washing your hands and saying a prayer is enough to, let's wake up. Let's wake up. Let's be present. Think about prayer. Rob Bell introduced this to the world as a simple two-word prayer: show me, show me. And he mentions how as he goes about his days, he simply has this mantra: show me. What's the next thing? What's the next thing? Richard Rohr has a little mantra he does to help him stay awake too. It's just this, just this. When we find ourselves overwhelmed with worry and anxiety about the future, we can sort of deep breath, just this. Let me be here and focused on just this person in front of me, just this one conversation. Or like this one, ask yourself, what's lacking in this moment? What is lacking in this moment? I don't know about you, but I live with I'll just say it. I'm constantly tempted to lack gratitude in life. Gratitude doesn't come easily to me. There's always something wrong with every situation for me. But I love this little, what is lacking in this moment? Because as soon as you can identify what it is, well, then do it. What's lacking in this moment? Well, whatever it is, be the one to do it. Or again, another Rob Bell mantra is, what is the next right thing? Because that's the only thing we can ever do, right? What is the next right thing? Whatever that is, do it. We start 2023, and as we strap on our boots and get actually moving on this Jesus path thing, let me ask you, what would it mean to wake up to your life? To be fully present as we travel the Jesus path together? I think it is simply this: showing up, being fully present wherever we are.